You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
There was a little bar in Mill Valley where all the Starfleet trainees used to go.
The 602 Club.
You know it.
I was there more times than I can remember.
Sit down.
I take it that this is not a social call, 007.
Correct. You should have brought lilies.
May I ask why?
Smertspionem.
Smertspionem was a Beria operation in Stalin's time. It was deactivated 20 years ago.
Two of our agents are dead.
My condolences. We had nothing to do with it.
Welcome to the 602 Club, Trek FM's General Geek Show. I'm your host here, Matthew Rushing, and I'm just so excited to be here. It's a refined and classy night as we are coming at you live from Kabuchi. I know a great restaurant there, and everybody's really excited to be digging in. But before we get started, just want to remind you, you can find Trek FM all over the place. We're on iTunes at itunes.com/Trek FM. And of course, the 602 Club is there. Hit us up with a star rating and review. It's been a while since we've had one of those, and it really does help people find the show and help it grow. So if you love what we do here, or if you have some suggestions or whatever, just hit us up. Let us know what you're thinking, and we'll thank you for your review on the show. Also, make sure you're following us on Twitter at Trek FM. And while you're in iTunes or wherever you're getting your podcasts, hit subscribe, because the moment that I publish a show, you will get the show. So make sure you're doing that. Also, you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/Trek FM. We've got our own website at trek.fm, which while you're over there, if you are maybe wanting to send us an email, you can go to trek.fm/contact. Choose the show, choose the 602 Club, and that'll come to me and anybody else who's on that week. And then last but not least, we've got our listeners-only discussion group, which is a great place to converse with all of the fans of Trek FM and, of course, the 602 Club. You'll want to find that on Facebook, and it's called The Babel Conference. So while you're on Facebook, type The Babel Conference, and you'll find us. Or if you are on our website and you're on any of the show pages, you'll see a little button that says Discussion. You can hit that, and it'll bring you over, and we can let you right into the group. But I'm really excited because we are diving in to James Bond again. And of course, you know that if we're doing James Bond, that we have to have the one, the only, John Champion.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here again, of course, talking about Bond with two of the people I look forward to talking about Bond with more than anybody in the world. And tonight is a momentous show, a momentous occasion.
It absolutely is. And to have this momentous event, we have to have Christy Morris.
Hello. Thank you. I'm so happy to be back and, you know, having Ruby pour me something.
Ah, yes. Oh, man. She's pulled out the good stuff, too, tonight, because I think she was really excited that we are going to be finally. John, I think you put it correctly. This is a momentous shift. It's not very often that you have a new Bond to talk about. And tonight we move into the Timothy Dalton era, which is very exciting. We made it through the Roger Moore era. And unfortunately, as I think everybody knows, that era kind of ends on a whimper. So the question becomes, as we continue Bond, can we reignite the spark of hope in this character? And I think it's so interesting because there are two things they have to figure out as they're continuing Bond. And one, what's the story going to be? And I wanted to ask you guys, Hubert, because I thought it was so fascinating that they actually thought about kind of going back and doing a prequel to the series. So going back and talking about James Bond as a younger character, maybe his coming up in the ranks and those kind of things. And so I wanted to ask you, is that an idea that appeals to you? Because even though they didn't do it here, is it still something you might want to see?
it's something that I would have wanted to see, actually. And, you know, initially you think about it, you're like, well, who would be the right actor to play a young Bond anyway? I think would be the most difficult choice. But I think that it's something that you're sort of always left to wonder, you know, once he becomes 007, we already know all of that stuff. But we don't know how he got to that point and what kind of family life he had, or, you know, if he had a first love or anything before he officially started working as 007. So I would have found that interesting personally.
Well, I mean, I think we got the reboot that we all wanted when we got Daniel Craig. So we got a solid four upcoming fifth story. We got a solid four stories that tell Bond's backstory. I think in 1987, it wasn't the right time to reboot, restart, reinvent Bond. Although what we do get is a stylistic reinvention and a bit more grounding with Bond here. But I think had this happened in 87, I think that you're then faced with the question of, well, what do you do? Do we do a period piece? Do we put Bond back in the early 60s and try to tell a story that's there? Or do we ignore what has come before? And we all know that Bond has played very fast and loose with continuity. There, nothing about this series is strictly contiguous from one film to another. There are little hints that just say, like, these are character traits that kind of show up again. Like we talked about Bond visiting Tracy's grave, that shows a tie between two different Bonds of two different eras. But I'm glad that they did what they did here and just kept it contemporary, didn't try to force anything to fit, and didn't try to reinvent the franchise. I think it was all pretty much the right decision at the right time.
That it seemed more like it was the next chapter in a long novel rather than starting over.
Yeah, very much so.
You know, it's something that I've talked to my friend Nick Anastasio about, and he and I have discussed the idea of, you know, going back and telling a 60s era story, and not necessarily it being a prequel, because we have gotten that now, as you said, John, just marvelously with the Daniel Craig films. Whether you love every single one of them, I think pound for pound, Daniel Craig's era has been the most successful, because each one has been a quality film. You know, John, you and I talked about Quantum of Solace, and I think, you know, I had always really enjoyed the film for the most part. It's not perfect. It's not great in the sense of, like, Casino Royale, but when you put those two together, they made a nice duology, and then they created a nice part of that quadrilogy that we've gotten so far. But the idea of kind of going back and maybe going back to the 60s and creating another adventure with Bond there, I think is something that you could do now. I agree with you, John. I think that in the late 80s, I don't know if we're quite at a place where people would accept Bond going backwards like that. Mm-hmm. I think that's something you could possibly consider doing after Daniel Craig, though, because I think people might be okay with that. So, because you can always craft interesting adventures for him to do there. I don't know, it would be kind of fun to see a film. I guess we saw with The Man from U.N.C.L.E., I feel like how you could really do it. It could work,
yeah,
you know. You can really make that work. So, I agree with you, though. I don't think this was quite the right time. So, they don't go with that idea, but they do know they need something. They need it to feel fresh by going backwards. And so they go back to Fleming and they pull out his short story, Living Daylights, which expires kind of the first bit of the film, the opening credit sequence, and then some of what we get in the beginning of the film. And I thought it was interesting because their idea is to kind of ground him again, basically kind of the way that they wanted to do with For Your Eyes Only. Get it back to that. You could still have gadgets and everything, but you want Bond as a character to feel more grounded. And I think that's something that they work very hard on in this film, is to make Bond almost feel more real again. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to know for you guys how you feel do they pull that off? Do they make Bond feel a little bit more human here again?
For me, yeah. I think that especially with having Timothy Dalton as Bond, I do think it's hard at first for people probably to switch from knowing more for so long, having to go with this completely new person taking the role, because there is a distinct difference in the way that Dalton and Moore carried themselves. I think that Dalton comes across tougher, but yeah, definitely more real, if only for the locations that they're going to. Just the things that they're doing there are not that outlandish. You know, he's not going to the moon or anything like that.
Well, I mean, you know.
That's always going to be my go-to. You know, they're skiing, or there's, you know, a milk delivery guy being taken down. It's everyday kind of things that we're all used to, even though it's in foreign countries that maybe we haven't been to. So I think that they did a good job of, yeah, making him more grounded and real in everyday things.
Yeah, even just right from the beginning, right from that pre-credit sequence, you feel the reality of the mission, that, well, the training slash the mission when it turns real. You feel the sort of the more grounded physical presence that Timothy Dalton has. I mean, look, I remember when this movie came out that the only Bond I had known for my entire life was Roger Moore. The occasional Sean Connery VHS tape that I would get to watch, but it's a very different experience seeing that than seeing something on the big screen in the anticipation of new Bond every couple of years being Roger Moore. But Roger Moore inhabited the role for more than 10 years, and that's a good long run. I remember when this came out, just feeling immediately like this was something different, something new, and this guy was cut from a different cloth. And that immediately brings you in. And they hit all the hallmarks right in that opening credit sequence very wisely. They give the characters, well, a particular Bond, they give some gravitas to what's happening. They give you a twist, and then they give you the other twist at the end where they make it a little sexy. And so it's like everything you want out of Bond right there in a couple of minutes before we even get to the credits. So it was really wisely plotted out the way they gave us this new guy.
And I like the subtle way that they bring Bond into this movie, because, you know, usually in the Roger Moore films, it felt like pretty much from the get-go, they're showing you his face and reminding you we're following the adventures of the Roger Moore Bond. Whereas this, I felt like they were kind of understanding that this may be a difficult transition for fans to go from Moore to Dalton. And so they didn't immediately go straight to Dalton as the one in the action. You know, that he's sort of one of three guys, and you eventually get to him, and then you realize, oh, he's going to be Bond.
It's a little bit like the opening of Honor Majesty's Secret Service, where we don't spend a lot of time on Bond's face. None, really, until we hit the end of the scene. So it's easing you into it.
Well, that never happens in the other film.
Exactly.
You know, I like what both of you are saying, because I think it's the way that this movie begins, it just lets you know that we are kind of back to a little bit more of a grounded, somewhat visceral feel. We're going to have fun, you know, as the landing on the boat and saying I'll be there in a couple hours mm-hmm. lets you know. But I feel like even just Dalton doing so much of his own stunt work there really helps sell that this guy is this character. He is this kind of action-packed, and he is a little bit more... There's something going on behind the eyes that feels very Bond from the novels of he is a cold-blooded killer. He's a stone-cold killer who pretends to not be with people. Like, because there are mm-hmm. moments in the film where he will just turn it on and he's scary. And I love that, you know, because I feel like that really captures the Bond. And so I feel like they just find a way, though, and all of that to also just make the character more human. But I also feel like that the story, they find a way to make it reflect the world of the 80s,
yes,
where we are in the late 80s. There are some parts of it that are slightly outlandish with some of the characters because it's Bond. But there's a sense of reality to the situation in all of that. And I think everything there kind of makes Bond and the character feel relevant and comfortable with where they are. And this is a really good job with writing a script. It's been a while since I would call out that the Bond movie actually had a decent script, really. This one, they did a fantastic job, I think, of really putting together a story that felt like something that had come from Fleming and felt more like that character that we saw in Dr. No, or, you know, For Your Eyes Only, or, you know, The Spy Who Loved Me, or Goldfinger, you know, From Russia With Love, those kind of hallmark Bond films. This just, I felt like it feels more like that. Mm-hmm. So, interesting behind the scenes on who would be Bond, because there were a lot of tough choices they had to make. And I thought this was fascinating. And watching the screen test, Sam Neill, everybody knows from Jurassic Park, I think, the most, tested. Everybody loves him. They think he's great. They want him to be Bond. And Broccoli's like, nope.
What is his problem?
Huge problem. Because if Cubby doesn't like him, then you're not going to have him be Bond. But watching that screen test, he was really good. He kind of felt almost like an extension of a little bit or slightly more grounded Roger Moore. He even kind of has that look almost. So I was surprised that there's something that Cubby just doesn't like, and he never explains it in any of the extras. But man, can you imagine Sam Neill as James Bond?
I love Sam Neill, and I would have liked to have seen his take on James Bond. I mean, I'm glad that things played out the way they did, but yeah, that's too bad.
Yeah, you immediately think of just how charming he can be in the other roles that we've seen him in. And, you know, I mean, even in Jurassic Park. And then it also, he can kind of play both sides. I feel like he can be that charming 007 kind of vibe. And then he can also come across as very, like, fatherly. But Bond even does that sometimes as well. So I think that Sam would have been great. But, yeah, I'm still glad that we get Dalton, too. I just kind of wish now that we could have fit Sam in somewhere.
Well, and what's fascinating is that this is also the point where Brosnan almost becomes Bond. Mm-hmm. They have him. He is going to be their Bond. And then because he's cast as Bond, Remington Steele, which was canceled, decides we need to do more episodes because of the hype. And so they pull him out. They pull him back because of his contract, because he had a 60-day option, and he doesn't get to be Bond because of that.
Yeah.
And I just feel so bad for him, because I want to ask you this question. There is quite a big gap between License to Kill and what we get in Goldfinger in time. There's a decent gap there. Do you feel like that if maybe Brosnan had just been Bond, we would have had less of a gap?
I mean, License to Kill and GoldenEye?
Yeah, GoldenEye is what I meant to say.
I'm really glad that things played out the way they did. Because, look, I loved Remington Steele when that show was on the air. But I also know that you go back and look at that show, and Pierce Brosnan looks like a kid. He needed to age a little bit into the role. And look, at this point in 2018, looking back at GoldenEye, that movie is 20 years old, but or more. I can't remember the exact date that came out.
95.
Wow. All right. So it was more than 20 years old. Yeah. And now Pierce Brosnan is in a different sort of age of his career. But I feel like if you had cast him in that role, and look, this is, well, as we say on Mission Log, this is jumping the timeline a little, but fast forwarding to Brosnan's portrayal of Bond, it was a lighter version than certainly what Timothy Dalton was doing. And to me, it would be almost a little too much like the return to Roger Moore. So, especially if you, seeing how his movies played out over time, seeing how the Brosnan movies played out over time. So I'm glad that we just had a total change of gears going to Dalton. I'm glad that Brosnan got to sort of cool out for a while. Look, I wish Timothy Dalton had done at least two more Bond films. And I would have been glad if Brosnan had come in after that, too. You know, I think Brosnan has the genetic blessing that he ages very well. And, you know, in his 50s, probably could have carried off playing Bond better than Roger Moore did playing Bond in his 50s. I can't picture how that would have... Maybe going back to your original question, Matt, maybe I could picture Brosnan playing a prequel James Bond at that age in 1987, easier than I could picture him playing a modern James Bond for the 80s in 1987.
Yeah, I agree with you, John. And also even from the standpoint of if you're trying to differentiate, go in a different direction than you were going with Moore, then yeah, I don't think that it would have made sense to bring in Brosnan yet, because like you're saying, I think that he would have been too young and it wouldn't have fit. Even though this one doesn't, you know, immediately seem like a sequel to A View to a Kill, I think just purely from wanting to go in a new direction, it's better that they went with someone else.
Mm-hmm. I think the thing that I feel is that I feel bad for Brosnan because of, again, jumping the timeline where his series goes. I feel like these two Dalton movies are better movies to start off in, mm-hmm. you know, and it's too bad that he doesn't get that opportunity. I'm glad, though. I mean, Timothy Dalton, and I think, you know, so to kind of wrap that up, and we'll get to the next session where we just talk about him. Because of all these delays that happen, he's finished with his film Brenda Starr and is now available to play Bond. And they had courted him before. They had courted him years and years and years ago to play him when Moore was still playing the role. And he had told them no. He felt like he was too young to speak to that. You know, that whole idea was Pierce too young at this point. And Cubby had always liked him, and it's Felicity. It works out perfectly for him to be able to take the role. And he goes from one day filming Brenda Starr over the weekend flying to play Bond. So he is the new Bond. And I wanted to ask you guys, we've touched a little bit on it, but, you know, Dalton only gets two films, but what do you think of his take of the character here in A Living Daylights?
I love it. Have I said that enough? I think I said earlier that I was waiting to get to Timothy Dalton. Not to knock on Roger Moore, but I didn't like Roger Moore as much as I liked Dalton and then Connery and then Craig. I really think that he brings a nice difference to this role. I think that he is more serious, but I like that it doesn't seem like he needs any gimmicks or like a silly one-liner to get a woman or to get stuff done or whatever. You know, it seems like the woman on the boat, for example, says, "I just wish I could find a real man." And then he just lands there and it's like, he doesn't have to say anything. He just goes, "I'm here."
That's right. This Bond gets ship done.
Exactly. But yeah,
he's magnificent. He really is. I mean, I remember liking him at the time, but there's something about, you know, what we've been doing here, this methodical study of the Bond movies in order like this, and then going through all the Roger Moore films, which I mostly enjoyed, but when there are clunkers, there are real clunkers, and they're painful. But man, seeing Timothy Dalton swoop in on that boat and just look like a million bucks, but also look like you believe him in that world, and you believe that he's been on a mission, and you believe that his life was in danger. Like, everything about it, he just absolutely sells. And the humor in the movie, with rare exceptions, really works. Because you feel like, okay, they're not writing in jokes. They're not writing in J.W. Pepper. They're not writing in the triple take pigeon. They don't have to. There's just a natural little bit of humor. I mean, Matt, you started off the show with the joke about knowing the restaurant in Afghanistan. You know, that's sort of a perfectly delivered James Bond line that reminds the audience, like, look, you're in a fantasy world in a movie. These people are having fun. But we're not going to stop and, like, slap you across the face with a stupid joke. And it's a really fine line for the Bond movies to find the gravitas and find the danger in it, but also lighten it up from time to time without making you just sort of cringe and go, wow, this is stupid.
But it feels like they finally realized what we've been saying this whole time with all the other movies was that you can be funny without having something ridiculous like the J.W. Peppers or the pigeons or the camel or, you know, anything else like that. You know, you can deliver a joke like he does about Karachi or when he says it must have scared the living daylights out of her. It was just subtly funny.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the thing that I was responding to the most in his take on Bond is the nuances that he adds to the character. The way he subtly shifts to being the sexy guy, you know, when he lands on the boat, you know, and he goes from being totally in action mode to being like, all right, time for some sex, you know, the point where there's the shift when he's with Kara and they're at the amusement park. And there's the shift that he goes in. He turns from being sweet and kind to being the killer, to being cold. And it's fast and quick. And like the nuances that he adds to the character are very interesting to me, and it makes them feel more human, because in those moments you're seeing that he's feeling betrayed, and so he turns it off. You know, he has a subtlety about him, and he feels like a human being. He's not perfect. You know, Dalton even said, look, Bond is not a Superman. He's just a dude. So he plays him like a man. And I feel like you get that in this movie, and it's because of what he's adding to the character. And I think part of it is that, you know, Dalton did some research by reading some Fleming to get into the mindset of this character. I think it really does show in his betrayal. And, you know, I would say so far, he's given Sean Connery a huge run for his money on being the most quintessential Bond to what Fleming wrote ever. And I think that's what we're all responding to, is that Dalton is kind of nailing what we intrinsically know. Even if you haven't read any Fleming, you kind of have this idea of what the quintessential Bond is like. And I think he's just kind of nailing it, which makes this an absolute pleasure to be watching. As a Bond movie, especially coming off those later Moore films, because it feels like an actual character in the way that I felt like Bond was an actual character when I was watching early Connery movies, or when I watched Craig movies, or even when I watched on Her Majesty's Secret Service, where the guy feels like a real person and not just an icon. And I think that's really important when we have Bond. And Dalton, again, I think he's just, he's nailing it, so.
And I like that you added that too, Matt, that he's not Superman, you know. He can do a lot, but he can't do everything. And so I like that portrayal of, you know, Dalton coming in as, I'm just a guy that is doing the best he can.
Yeah. We've got all these interesting 80s era villains in the movie. And not all of them are actually villains. They seem like they might be, but they are not necessarily. And I think that's one of the fascinating things. And you know, we've got Afghanistan with Russia in the news, then kind of the rise of international arms dealers. And at this point in history, we're honestly not too far from Russia just collapsing anyway. So there is a change, and the movie really reflects that. And so we got Jodan Baker as Brad Whitaker playing the arms dealer, and he's the part of the movie that I think is maybe a little too silly. I wish that they had reined it in just a little bit, made him a little bit more serious as a character, because he kind of feels like a doof.
But I like the way they set him up, though. I like the reveal he's a failure.
He's a pretender.
No pun intended there. Yeah, he's a failure with these delusions of grandeur. And he's pulling off the biggest con of all, which is not just making money, shifting goods back and forth, but presenting himself as something that he's not. So I'm glad that they gave him that edge instead of just the mustache-twirling villain who wants to take over the world. This is a guy who is trying desperately to figure out how to present himself to others, trying desperately to reach that level of the other villains that we've met. So yeah, it is a little over the top. It is played a little bit comedically, but again, it's like I look at a character as fleshed out as Brad Whitaker, and then I look at a character like J.W. Pepper, and I go, you know what? I'm glad there's no J.W. Pepper here.
Yeah, I think that I like your point, sort of that he's like the blue collar villain.
Yeah, right.
That, you know, he may come in with nothing, but he's gonna pretend until he's got nothing left.
Right.
You know, he really gets put down by Pushkin and told, well, you're just a nobody. Mm-hmm. But he really believes that he can, you know, be the best villain that there is. So you kind of admire him for that. I think that he carries himself in the way that all of the villains we like do. And it's definitely sort of a foreboding thing when you come into the hallway with all of the different statues, because I immediately, even on the rewatch, felt that sense of one of those is going to be a real person.
Right. Yeah.
So I love that stuff. And that he sort of has weapons all over the place that he could just seemingly pick up at some point and use on you, whether you're there for a meeting or you're an actual enemy. But yeah, I do agree that he sometimes feels like, I don't know if you noticed, he seemed to maybe have a Southern accent.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Which I thought was funny, but then also maybe kind of rubbed me the wrong way, like they were trying to portray as, you know, America as a whole being a little dumb.
Well, Jodan Baker is from...
Bond movies from never do that.
Yeah. Right.
Well, he's from Texas. But I thought, you know what, it doesn't matter really where he's from. He's just a guy faking it, no matter what.
Yeah, I just expect that he, at night, he falls asleep listening to those motivational tapes. You know, like, right. I am a
you
strong, confident villain. I will be the best villain there is.
Yes.
I will be a villain to be reckoned with. Oh, man. But yeah, no, I mean, I agree with you guys, because I do, what I like is the way that the character is written and everything. I wish that he was played a little less silly and just a little bit more, like, he is somebody who takes himself very seriously, but it turns out to just be a big boob,
right,
you know?
Right.
And so I kind of wish that there had been a little bit more seriousness to his character. So when he turns out to be a buffoon, it was a little bit more like shocking or something, like, you know, it wasn't just, well, this guy's just going to be,
mm-hmm, you're going to expect it to get silly.
Exactly. Yep. So like, you're just kind of waiting for him to fail instead of what I was hoping, you know, what I would hope with the movie, it would set him up to be somebody you don't realize is going to be that, so that when that happens, you're like, oh, so that's really who this is. Mm-hmm. So, but in the end, Brad Whitaker is great, and hint, hint, he might show up in a later Bond movie, just, you know, FYI. So,
and that gun with the bulletproof glass on the cover. Right?
Yeah, yes, yeah, that brilliant. Was it's pretty awesome. I really like Koskov in the movie. I love his role mm-hmm. of being a villain, but he's not like mustache twirling or anything. Mm-hmm. He seems like he's having a great time. Like, I don't know if he's just high the whole time on some cocaine or something, but he really thinks he's just going to get away with it all. And there are points like, you know, on the plane where Bond is figuring out how he's being played and everything. He's just great. I just, he felt like kind of a fresh take on a villain, you know, somebody who's really reveling in the fact that he's about to get away with all of his villainy.
Yeah. Well, it just speaks to the thing that we're saying, that everybody here feels like they belong in this world. You know, Bond is not real world, but you have to have some kind of internal consistency, and that's the thing that throws us off about the elements that don't work in the Roger Moore movies. At least in this, they all feel like they belong, and you have a character like Koskov, who is just over the top, but you buy it. You believe it. It's partly the actor selling it, but it's also the way that this movie is structured, where not everybody is as they seem. Everybody's got sort of overlapping yet different motivations for where they are and what they're doing. So it really plays out in a terrific way. It doesn't just dump on you like, oh, here's a bad guy. He's got a plan. You know, everybody's got some sort of relationship on what those plans are.
Yeah, I love Koskov. I thought that it was interesting having the dimension that he had, that, you know, you think that he's on the side with the Brits and then you realize what he's actually up to. But I think that it was a little too confusing. I don't know if they just didn't give enough dialogue or if the dialogue for me anyway was a little unclear, but I felt like it's hard to determine who's working for who until Saunders, Bond's friend, finally kind of gives him, here's the deal, when they're at the carnival. I feel like before then you're really confused, you know, as far as who's working for who.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I don't know if that isn't intentional to just keep everybody on their toes and try and keep you guessing, maybe. Because, yeah, I mean, like, and trying to figure out who Necros is, you know, aligned with and why, you know, how are they all relate to Pushkin and with this, you know, Brad Whitaker character. There is like a lot going on, but at least at the very end, I don't feel like it doesn't make sense, luckily. Mm-hmm. Like, they
yeah,
finally
like it
do.
Does come together.
Yeah, it comes together at least. So I love it when a plan comes together. what did you guys think of? I mean, I love John Rhys-Davies. So having him play Pushkin and kind of like, I love the fact that we don't know what way he's going to go, you know? And then I kind of love that Bond keeps making friends with all these Russians.
And that they seem to be saying, the KGB's not that bad. We're friends.
Right. Right.
Because they keep seeming to, you know, end up partnering together against somebody else. But yeah, I love John Rhys-Davies, but I definitely liked the back and forth with Pushkin and with not being sure whether he's the real villain of the film or if it's Koskov or somebody else. And I like definitely the whole scene where they're faking Pushkin's death, because he just says, well, then I have to die. And then you're wondering how they're going to do that or if Bond just went ahead and killed him then. So that the fact that they play it off, so public, so that, you know, Koskov and Necros think Pushkin is out of the picture is perfect. And then I think John Rhys-Davies is just the greatest guy to do that because he has this, demeanor about him that always cracks me up, whether, you know, it was Indiana Jones movies or Lord of the Rings or Princess Diaries 2, which is the most recent one I saw him in. He's really good at being very serious and then jumping to a joke. So I love him.
Yeah, he's good in everything all the time. He's just one of those.
He really
yeah,
is.
He's just one of those actors who is. So he's, and he's fabulous in this. And I love the danger of Bond dropping in on his room, and you really think that Bond's about to kill him, because Dalton sells that, and John Rhys Davies sells that moment. But then their alliance feels natural as well. It's perfectly played.
He's just so much fun. And I do like you, John, that scene is so scary, mm-hmm. Because of the way that Bond's using his girlfriend and everything. Well, I have to say that a little more Bond nudity than I remembered in this mm-hmm. movie. but it's well used, because I think it makes Bond seem very dangerous in that moment.
Yeah.
This is a moment where his license to kill may come into play, and he has no qualms necessarily about that. But what I love about that moment is that what it's doing for the character of Bond, that as he says to Pushkin, I wouldn't be here if I believed Kozkov.
Yeah.
You know, so this guy is, I think one of the things that I really liked about this movie is that Bond really is putting it together, and he's actually doing some spy detective work, mm-hmm. and that's nice to have that back. And I think one of the things that, you know, makes that really cool in the movie is that we have these helpful friends that he gets throughout the movie. And one of them, you know, Christy, you already mentioned, and I really enjoyed, his character is Saunders. You know, I thought that character was a lot of fun, mainly because I think he felt almost at times like the audience of the eye roll of like, oh, here we go again with the girl. Oh, here we go again, you know. And yet that scene, right, as he's about to leave his meeting with Bond, he gives him all the information. There's this like respect that he has for Bond when he sees what Bond has really been up to and why he's been doing it, when he puts it all together. Like, I really enjoyed that relationship because we don't get to see Bond interact with many other agents on the British side much. I thought that was really cool.
I like that it seems like they have a really good, almost like they're police partners kind of partnership, where even though in the beginning you feel like he's getting the short end of the stick, Saunders, when Bond decides to take over the plan and says, well, you know, it's on a need-to-know basis, and takes off in the car with the guy. Saunders is left standing there holding the guns going, what am I supposed to do with this? That later he does get that rapport and you see that respect between the two of them, like you said, Matt, where it seems like they've worked together for a while. They have a trust between each other, and that Saunders knows that he can, you know, give Bond the plans and then leave and things are going to be taken care of, basically. So, I really liked him, and kind of I think that's why his death hurts a little bit, because you care about him more than you do many of the other characters.
If all we had of Saunders was that opening stuff with he and Bond kind of bickering and this little bit of one-upmanship and all that, then we wouldn't have cared. You know, it would have just been somebody else, and it would have been Bond kind of being a smug jerk. But the fact that they brought that storyline full circle, they had them work together for a reason, so you could believe that they worked together, then gave his death some weight and gave it some emotional resonance. And by the way, did Necros have to contract out with the builders of that door early on? Like, you know, years before, just say, guys, can you, we need to make this door really, really strong, and it needs to have a remote activator in it. So, yeah.
That, or he is just a technical whiz at the local Radio Shack.
I guess so.
So,
yeah.
It's probably what it is. I also thought it was fascinating, you know, we get Cameron Shaw, one of the Afghans, who obviously has been trained at Oxford. We get some hints of kind of the background of that country, what's been going on in the world at that point. And I really like the way that he and Bond work together with Kara. I think it's really nice. And getting to the end of the movie where, you know, he shows up late to the concert and he's like, "Where's James?" You know, like, it's just, I really liked this character, and I thought it was so great that they were kind of giving us these interesting side characters that aren't just throwaways. Like, I enjoyed his story. I enjoyed even the way it starts, where he's just the guy in the jail pretending to be kind of stupid so they don't know who he is. Like, I just found all of that fascinating. And part of it, I think he references the history of what's happening in the world during the 80s at that point. And I think they do him a real service. And they do the Afghan story there a real service. They don't downplay it or make it feel stupid or anything like that. They really imbibe the character with some real dignity. And I think it's a real testament to the writing in this film that they give us a character like this.
He's such a standout. I mean, first of all, he photographs great, you know,
yeah.
Looks great on film. but for a guy who's in well less than half the movie, you learn so much about him and about that world that he occupies and the political situation there. They really get across so much, and he's sort of riveting in exposing all of that and being the conduit for that part of the story. He's terrific. Yeah, I wish we'd had more of him.
I agree, and I'll add that I think it was sort of like they were in a great way not making out Afghanistan to be a bad place overall. Like, it felt like they weren't putting down Afghanistan as a whole. They were saying that, you know, that there's good and bad people anywhere all over the world. And that, you know, there are people like Cameron who are going to be a good friend and stick up for you if you stick up for them, kind of thing. And so it was nice that, you know, Bond didn't have to let him out of the prison cell, but he was like, "Yeah, you know, what do I have to lose? I don't know this guy, but, you know, maybe he's not too bad." So he tosses him the keys. And then it turns out that guy can help them out later. And I really especially liked, speaking of giving the woman a little bit of credit, Cameron seeing Kara suddenly grab his gun and go, "There is more we can do to help Bond." And Cameron going, "Well," and the other guy's looking at him like, "What are you waiting for?" Follow her. So it was nice to feel like they became like brothers to her and were, you know, partnering together too.
Yeah, really. I mean, just really great job. And it, I wish, you know, they had found a way to have him somehow in the next film, just because like you said, John, I feel like he's a real standout to this movie and a character in Bond lore that you'd almost want to revisit. New Moneypenny. I don't have too much to say about Caroline Bliss. I don't really think she has too much to do. They don't give her much to do. And I don't think she feels like as memorable as, you know, Lois Maxwell. I mean, obviously, this is the first time that she gets to play her, and she only gets to play her once more. But I don't even know if she's as memorable as who we'd get for Brosnan with Samantha Bond playing that role. So
I remember this being a big deal when Caroline Bliss was announced as the new Moneypenny. And it just on a rewatch, I don't really love what they did with the character. They sort of made her awkward. And, you know, what we love about Moneypenny is this sort of mature flirtation. She's the one that Bond he'll never get, because even though she sort of wants him, she's smarter than that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But
he's just the eye candy that comes through the office she's in.
Right,
you know?
Right, so. Right. Yeah, but I really feel like they didn't know what to do with her. And it's a shame because, like I said, they built this up as a big deal that, you know, that we wouldn't have Lois Maxwell anymore. But, it didn't land with me. I'm anxious to see if my opinion changes in the next movie.
But I don't think necessarily it was a bad choice of the actress, more so just the writing of her.
Totally.
Because you don't get hardly any of her at all in the movie anyway, which, I mean, you don't usually get that much of Moneypenny, but a little more, I think, than this. And the way that they chose to portray Moneypenny in this felt very weak.
Mm-hmm.
As far as like her feelings for Bond really showing and being more than what we're used to Moneypenny giving. Like you said, John, that she's smarter than that. Whereas in this film, it feels like they're making Moneypenny out to like constantly be pining for Bond and just, oh, well, I guess I'll never get him.
Right, right.
Yeah, a little bit too goo-goo-eyed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and that's just not.
She's better than
who
that.
We think.
She's better than
yeah,
that.
Yeah. Well, and I always, like you said, John, I feel like, you know, with Lois Maxwell and her, the bonds that she got to play with, she has, it is a very mature give and take between them, you know, and she gives to Bond just as good as he gives to her, you know, and their back and forth flirtation banter. It's very consensual and everything. This felt more like almost like a teenage girl looking up to the boy who's a little bit too old for her, you know, and
yeah.
that's not the feeling you want. You want them to feel like equals in that sense. So I did love, because I kind of forgot that we got Felix Leiter in the movie. And I really like John Terry. He was very enjoyable, and the way that he gets Bond to him was great. It was fantastic. Like he knows how to get Bond.
Yeah, have two women pull up and say, "You want a party?"
Yep.
Yeah, that was great.
I get that scene. Although I always wondered why it is that in the Bond films, like, so many times the introduction of the good agent that Bond is supposed to meet, whether it's Tiger Tanaka or our first introduction to Felix way back in Dr. No, like, they want Bond to think he's about to die, but, it, you know, so, oh, no, but it's okay, we're good guys. Like, well, why didn't you just say, why didn't you just send a memo early on? It's like, yeah, your guy in Tokyo, it's Tiger Tanaka, you're going to meet him, and here's how you're going to meet him. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to kill you on the
because,
way there.
Because, John, we can't give away the position.
Right? I honestly do not know what to make of this Felix Leiter. I feel like it, to me, the actor does not stand out. Like, I get it. Every time we reintroduce Felix, we sort of give him a fresh coat of paint. We don't know what we're going to get next time. They just, why not? We'll just recast Felix as many ways as we can. This guy feels like, to me, he stepped out of an Andy Sedaris made-for-cable movie from the 80s. I just don't quite get him. He's not memorable. The introduction is memorable. The girls in the car, but the guy, all of that. But Felix himself, he didn't land with me.
Yeah, I don't
I agree
think
with
they
you
give
there.
Him enough to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I guess I don't have a love or hate thing with him. He's just kind of like there. I did at least didn't feel that it was just, oh, we're adding one more layer. Like, It fit organically enough because they had showed that boat that he's on.
Yep.
Earlier, and you didn't quite know what that was just yet, but you realize that he's been under surveillance, and so their conversation about they've been working the same thing for both sides, you know, and they haven't been talking yet. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It was okay. I mean, the fact that he drinks Jim Beam, though, I'm really, I mean, Felix
product placement.
Right.
Yeah, he needs to work on his alcohol consumption. Get some better stuff. But we do have another helpful friend, And I don't know if you guys were excited as I was, but having a new Aston Martin in, the V8 Vantage, whoo, this car is beautiful. It's absolutely gorgeous. And it just felt so right to be back in Aston Martin.
It did. Very sleek and stylish. I liked the color. I liked all of the different buttons that he got to push. I think that was some of the most fun of this movie was all of the gadgets in the car.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, look, it feels right that again, it's the production telling the audience, we're getting back to some basics with Bond here, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Roger Moore had some cool cars. Roger Moore had a car with a lot of awesome buttons in it too, but there's something about putting Bond back in an Aston Martin where it just, there's that continuity again. It doesn't have to be a strict story continuity. It's just something about the world that he inhabits that of course he should be in an Aston. And it is a beautiful looking car. I'll take two.
I think the thing that's fascinating is that for the 80s, this is a gorgeous car. The 80s aren't known for gorgeous cars, really. But this Aston Martin
looks...
No, it's
known for boxes.
Yeah, it looks very classic and sleek, like you said, Christy, and it has all these really nice lines. And what's funny is that it actually feels more like a 60s car. Like, it feels like... it reminds me of some of the very late 60s Mustangs. You know, with the lines that it has and things like that. But it just, you know, if you're going to put Bond back in a, this is Bond's back in the saddle. He's back in the saddle again, and you know it because he's in an Aston Martin, and it just, it feels so right, you know? And I just ride like every time that the car is on screen. It's just, I'm with you, John. I'll take two.
And
just
then you
one
were
for
so
the weekend.
Sad when it crashed.
And,
yes.
You know, yeah. But so we haven't talked about yet, but this is something that's interesting. We have a Bond woman, not women. We don't really get more than one. You know, minus the pre-credit sequence. An interesting thing. In the late 80s, obviously, they even talked about it on the extras. There's a lot of talk about monogamy and safe sex, and like we're looking at these kind of things differently at that time period. And so, this is a Bond movie where we really only have one Bond woman, and I have to say, you know, I think it felt really nice to come into this movie and only have one woman that Bond has a relationship with, because it made it feel more realistic. It made it like when they are giving them those lines, it felt more real because of all the stuff that they had been through. And she turns out to be pretty kick-ass. You know, from going to be a cello player to riding around with the, you know, Afghan resistance fighters. Yeah. You know, she's pretty awesome. So
riding
really
a horse while holding a machine gun.
Yes. She's fantastic. Like, I really, really end up liking her. And, you know, riding down a hill on a cello case aside, she really, I think, she brought out a side of Dalton where there was a part of him that was actually caring towards her and loving towards her. And I'm trying to think of the word. Like, he was very moved by her. Like, in the moment when they're in Shaw's compound and she's so worried, and he's just kind of holding her and hugging her, and like he's being so sentimentally sweet to her in a way that feels organic and real and true, that you haven't really seen with Bond, except for when, you know, we had Honor Majesty's Secret Service with Tracy. Like, this feels like the first time in a very long time Bond has a kind of true relationship with somebody. I just really enjoy the portrayal, this character, and I think it works. And I think she's a hallmark for Bond women.
I think so, absolutely. I really like that she seems to give off both that vulnerable side that she needs Bond to protect her, but then also can be trusted to be left to her own devices and do what she needs to do, because Bond still got a job to do. You know, his job is not to look after Kara. I like, especially in the scene where he's driving the plane and she's trying to figure out where he is, finally figures out he's driving the plane, and then she's driving beside him in the Jeep. And he's like, just get in the back. And she's going, what? but it feels like there is a, even though he's protective of her and does seem to clearly care about her, that there's a mutual respect, and that he still feels like she's capable, even though she's a woman. And I was especially moved when the scene where they're in Afghanistan and she finds out that he might just leave her and go finish his mission on his own, that she gets upset and then he gets upset seeing her sad. And that's not typically something we see Bond getting a little more emotional. So I liked that aspect.
Yeah, she was great in it, and their chemistry and their interplay was really good. And it was integral to the story. Like, you know, there was something that, as I remember in 1987 when this movie came out, the press made a big deal. And I went, oh, there's only one Bond woman in this movie, but that's not right, because all the other movies, there's been at least two or three or more, you know. And trying to make this case to say that this was a definite decision by the production to address AIDS and the sort of the emphasis on monogamy at the time and all. And I thought, you know what? Look, let's just take it down to the story. The story that this movie needs to tell is their story. That's the focus. And it doesn't work. You can't tell that story if you just introduce a bunch of other weird plot elements. Like, look, I'll even say that for as many problems as there are with The View to a Kill, Bond has a couple of hookups in that movie, and for the most part, they make sense. You know, you go back to The Spy Who Loved Me. Now, there's a chemistry there between Bond and Major Amasova, but it's a different kind of chemistry that movie needs to explore. This, like you've hit on, Chrissy, is about her vulnerability and her having these parts of the story revealed to her, and then finding the strength to kind of, you know, own up to what she's got to do in this particular plot thread of her life. So, yeah, I mean, it is a little bit of a change of pace that we don't have Bond just like hopping into bed with an enemy agent or whomever. You know, you kind of indicate that with the girls in the car who were sent from Felix's office. But to me, it just sort of, take a step back from the movie and the rest of the context, and you go, well, yeah, they had to tell this movie this way. This is the story. This is the only way that story gets to be told. Otherwise, we're just shoehorning scenes in there that make no sense. So why would we do that?
Right. Yeah. I think it's like a focus on good storytelling, not necessarily, well, the formula has always had four women, so we've got to have four women in this one just because.
Yeah. And here's the thing. If that had been justified by some reason in this story that, oh, well, Bond has to seduce an enemy agent or whatever, okay, fine. If you can justify it, then you can justify it. This movie doesn't need to justify something else because it works the way it is.
Yeah. I mean, I think that when I go back to, like, on Her Majesty's Secret Service, where he's sleeping with a lot of the women there, but it's because he's trying to find out different things from them on the mountaintop, you know, at the Institute. And he's doing it specifically for a reason. It is part of the story. It is part of his spy work to try and understand what's happening here so he can stop a catastrophe for the world. But that's also the same movie in which the real love story is between him and Tracy. And that works so well. So, but this specifically, the story, like you said, Christy, the story they're telling, this is the story, and it's about the story. And luckily we have a good story, so we really care about the character. and the characterization of the two. And I think what I liked, you kind of both mentioned, there's a vulnerability to her, but I think she brings out a vulnerability in Bond, which is really neat.
Yes.
That it's okay for Bond to, again, be human, to be a man. And he's not Superman, and he's not a cold-hearted bastard, you know. He has feelings, and you see that throughout the movie and the way that he reacts to her in different places. Because when he thinks, again, when he thinks that she's betrayed him, he turns on the coldness. And when he realizes that she didn't mean to do something or whatever, like, okay, it's back, because there's that human reaction of, oh, I've been betrayed. Like, I just love the way that it brings out the characterization, and they're both so well characterized that I never feel like either of them is just like taking advantage of the other, or I mean, it everything feels very real between them. And so I really like that about the film. And she's definitely, in the estimation of Bond women, she's become one of the top women now just because of what they do with the character, you know? So it's really well written. Got some amazing action in the movie. I mean, we got to talk about we talked a little bit about the opening credit sequence, how awesome that was. But I mean, the whole thing with the plane is awesome. And it still looks so good.
Yeah, look, put that up against any CG that's being done now. And I'm sorry. All that stuff with that C-130, correct? Yeah. Is just so good. And as I've said before about many other things, it blowed up real good.
Well, and the thing that really built the tension for me, as I'm sure it does everyone, is the cutting back and forth between Bond and Necros hanging on the bags and the one strand that's about to break. And just the back and forth of they're still hanging on and it's breaking. Oh my God. Oh my God. You know, it's a constant buildup. And so it's great. And then that paired with the tension of, as my husband would say, a woman driving.
Oh, God.
No, I'm kidding. He throws that one in my face all the time, but I think it's funny. But, you know, she doesn't necessarily have a pilot's license. We don't know that. And so you're thinking this is a civilian who's never flown a gigantic military plane. And he's going, just hold it straight. She's going, okay. And then she sees this going on in the background and doesn't know that this strand is about to break as well. So it does a lot for creating a really intense fight scene and last battle.
Yeah, we all know she plays a cello for the living, you know?
Right.
She doesn't drive planes.
Yes, yes.
She didn't fly planes. And so, no, I'm right there with you. And I think, like you said, John, this is something that looks so good still. Every bit of a special effects work here looks amazing. And when they do the whole part where the plane is going to crash and the parachute pops out with the Jeep, everything, the way it's edited, it still looks like it really happened. Yeah. Like, it's
especially the Jeep just sliding off. It seems so seamless.
Absolutely. And it's great because that part there is model work, but you can't tell.
Yeah.
It's just so good. So, I mean, the action, and then of course all the action happening around there is good. You know, with, as they're getting on the plane and everything, there's all of the amazing fight work happening with the the big old dumper running through all the buildings, and you've got the Afghan rebels, you know, fighting the Russians, and it's just there's so much
explosions.
I mean, it's just, it's a great scene. So I think it's just so well done and ends the movie so perfectly, I think. And so this also will be the last movie that John Barry does a score for with Bond. And so I wondered what you guys thought of his work here, since it's his last go around.
I didn't really notice that much. And I think that's a good thing, I guess, is what I'm trying to say overall. I feel like if it's really a good score, that it's seamless in the background and fits the action. So I felt like it was good and definitely didn't have anything ridiculous like a penny whistle thrown in here and there that ruined a good scene. Overall, it was good.
I have to say that I think this is one of the first CDs that I owned and bought for myself. So I was very familiar with the music and then was really glad to rewatch the movie and recognize those music cues. I love this soundtrack from beginning to end. I love the Aha theme song. I love the stuff that the Pretenders contributed. And I love John Barry's Bond music in here because it is very much of the time, but it's not dated and cheesy of the time. It just fits sort of perfectly where you're introducing more electronic instruments into the score. You're kind of modernizing what we know about Bond, but it doesn't feel suddenly dated. And let's face it, we've definitely heard some places in Bond soundtracks where it just suddenly feels dated. Like it was good for a second, maybe when that movie came out, and then it stopped being good.
Goldeneye.
but I love this soundtrack. In fact, when I leave here, I will probably put that on in my car and listen to it on the way home.
John, just no speeding.
I can't help myself when I put on a Bond soundtrack. I'm sorry.
And no missiles.
Missiles.
Conditions. How dare you?
Yeah, it was really cool and it was really interesting learning that John Barry, they recorded the orchestra, and then they overlaid on top of that the synth music. And so it was the first time that that had ever been done, where they had recorded an orchestra and then they overlaid on top the synthesizer work. And I think for the most part, you're right, John, it really does work here. And it works for the film. It never really stands out in the sense of like pulling you out. Like, oh, that sounds like, you know, Lady Hawk. So it's really effective for the film. And there's some points where it's so very classic James Bond. It's helping to sell Dalton's first film as fitting in with the rest of the canon of James Bond perfectly. I think it's doing exactly what it needs to do. The theme's not bad. You know, it's not one of my favorites, but it's not awful or anything. So there's nothing wrong with Aha's music here or the Pretenders' work. So I think what do you rate this? Because I feel like we got good things to say.
So for me, I feel like it really originally was lower on my list and has now risen back up closer to the top of my favorite Bond films because of number one, Timothy Dalton, number two, Jonathan Rhys-Davies, and then three, just having, like we all said, a compelling story and feeling like everyone contributing to it wanted that to be the number one goal, to bring it back down to some basics of what we know of Bond, maybe so that you're more okay with a transition to a new Bond. I think that the actress that played Kara, I'm forgetting her name, but did an excellent job in being someone respectable that's a good equal for Bond, but also having some vulnerability. And I think that the villains really worked here, even though, you know, like you were saying, Matt, that Whitaker could be a little bit of a doof sometimes, that he was still kind of creepy and you felt like he was, you know, meant what he said and that there really was a lot going on with him and Koskoff and Necros was really creepy to me, just even as a henchman. Overall, I guess I would give it a 8 out of 10 missile launchers.
Nicely said, Christy, because I think that when I first saw this movie in theaters, I liked it and I really liked Timothy Dalton as Bond, but I didn't love this movie. And I think with the distance of time and my own maturity because, I mean, I was a kid when this came out, right? And I was used to Roger Moore, and I was used to the over-the-top spectacle of the Bond films, right? So I liked this, but it felt like something was wrong. It felt like something was missing, even though I loved this new guy playing Bond, right? Well, of course I did, because he was Prince Baron in Flash Gordon, and no role is cooler than that ever.
And you love
and
Flash
I love
Gordon.
Flash Gordon with a passion.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about it in the 602 club. So,
but now rewatching it, and like I said earlier, rewatching it after studying the Bond films in order, and really studying the Roger Moore movies, wow! I mean, this just hit me like a ton of bricks. How different and how inspired it was to make it different. And bring in this actor and let him do his thing and inhabit Bond the way he's going to inhabit the role. But the story was much more engaging to me on a rewatch now than it really ever had been before. And I think maybe the politics and the geopolitical aspect of it felt much more real. Even though there is no Soviet Union now, but we all have an understanding of Afghanistan. We all have an understanding of people selling arms. We all have these sort of understandings now in the modern world of what those things mean. So I was much more engaged in the story this time, and I was much more engaged in the Bond and Kara relationship than I probably was when this originally came out. So doing this show, like you, really improved my appreciation of this, really enhanced my appreciation of it. So whereas before I would have said like, oh, okay, yeah, this is on the better end of a mediocre Bond film, maybe a 6 out of 10, something like that. Now I'm going to say it's an 8 out of 10. It's 8 electronic key fobs out of 10.
Man, that's awesome. I think you guys are encapsulating everything that I'm going to say, so I'll keep it short and sweet. This movie really rose in my estimation. I do think that part of that has to do with the drudgery that we had kind of been in for the last few movies. But at the same time, looking back through the lens of a little bit of maturity, I think that this is just a much better movie. And when I think about the movie story-wise, it's a much better movie. There is a good story here. There's a lot going on. It all fits together. It all comes together. Nothing feels so outlandish that I just want to like roll my eyes. And the beauty of letting Bond be more human in the same way that Daniel Craig was, I think, and what we all praise for him. And I feel like, you know, Dalton just won't get his due because he's a little bit before people are ready for this. But it's a great movie. It's a great Bond movie. It's a fun movie. I rewatched this, probably about 2 months ago, just because I hadn't seen it in so long and I just wanted to kind of get myself in a different mind frame than we were with Moore. And so I was so glad because watching it again, I was never bored or anything. Like, I'd just seen this a couple months ago, but I wasn't bored at all. This is such a great, fun Bond movie. I'd say it's one of the better Bond movies. In fact, I have a list on Letterboxd.com of my, and I've added this now, so there's 11 Bond movies, and they're in my top 11. This is in it now, because wow. It's just that good. So I would say that this is 8 out of 10 Aston Martins, because, and I would love to have 8 out
with
of 10
skis.
Aston Martins. With skis, right? Absolutely, yeah. Must have skis. Yeah. So I am so glad that we are here, and it's going to be a lot of fun this year because we've got this, then we'll have Brosnan coming up, and we at least have some good movies to talk about. So I'm so excited to be back. We're probably going to be releasing a Bond episode every other month, so you have time to be able to watch and digest along with us. But we're really excited because we'll be wrapping up the Bond series until whenever they bring out the new Craig film. So really excited about that. Thank you so much to the associate producers we have here through Patreon, Ken Tripp and Davis Grayson. Really appreciate them being with the show so long and making sure that everything on Trek FM keeps coming to you each and every week. It's a huge enterprise. We have so much happening here on Trek FM, and we can't do it alone. So go over to patreon.com/trekfm. You can see how you can be part of our team. Make sure everything we do keeps coming to you each and every week. So many great perks for you. So check it all out at patreon.com/trekfm. Christy, it's a joy to be back with you here in the new year talking about Bond. But let everybody know where they can find you if they want to catch up with you and all the other things you're doing.
Sure. So you can find me on Instagram and Twitter, primarily at Bespin Bell. And I am also, in addition to being on 602 Club, talking about Bond and other geeky topics sometimes, I also am now officially co-hosting a podcast called Galactic Fashion with Teresa Delgado. So we'll be doing that monthly. So look for me there.
And John, just fantastic to be back with you, my good sir. But you have so much going on these days. So let everybody know where they can find you and what else you're doing.
Well, production is kicking up here at Roddenberry World HQ. So check things out either at roddenberry.com or podcast.roddenberry.com. There's Mission Log. There's Mission Log Live. There are friends at Priority Woman One and Women at Warp. But we have some new stuff cooking up. So check back, check often at podcast.roddenberry.com. And if you want to talk to me directly, either at Mission Log Pod or at DVD Geeks, we're more than happy to geek out about Bond and other nerdy pursuits.
I just love how retro your handle is now. So it's fantastic.
Thank you.
But you really do want to follow John and Christy and everything they're doing. So make sure you check them out on social media and with their other podcasts. So do yourself a favor. You can find me on Twitter, MattRushing02. I'm also on Instagram under the same name. I moonlight here on the network with Chris Jones, where we talk about Deep Space Nine on The Orb. You can also find me on the Nerd Party Network talking about Harry Potter on a show called Owlpost. We go through one chapter at a time the whole series. So we're right there, almost done with The Prisoner of Azkaban. Check that out. I am on another podcast called Aggressive Negotiations, which you can find on the Nerd Party Network. And my good friend John Mills and I talk all about Star Wars. We have really been digging into some Last Jedi content, so make sure you check it out. I think you'll love it. Last but not least, doing kind of what John does on Mission Log, but with film, morals, meanings, messages about movies, but specifically through the lens of faith with my friend Courtney over on Cinema Stories, so you can check that out. And thank you so much for joining us. And y'all come back now. You hear?